As you will see from the rolling waves in the background, we are in somewhere wonderful, just San Diego, at the Catamaran Resort. This is the third biennial conference of the International Mind, Brain and Education Society, and I'm actually talking to one of the panelists who will be giving a talk later on during the day, Terry Jernigan. Now, I am puzzled because I know you from UCSD. You're a professor of psychiatry.
I'm a professor of cognitive science.
But also, it says...
But also of psychiatry.
Right, psychiatry.
And radiology.
And you run the Center for Human Development.
Yes.
And you're also part of the TDLC, the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center. How does this all come together? I mean, what's the connections here?
Well, I've been interested in using brain imaging techniques for many,
yeah.
many years.
Yeah.
And I have studied brain development and brain aging and a number of different neuropsychiatric disorders, including some neurodevelopmental disorders. So my research with brain imaging has been very broad for many years. In recent years, I've done a lot of work on HIV infection in the brain, for example.
Yeah.
And substance abuse, which often travels with HIV infection in the brain. But about, it's getting to be close to 10 years ago, I think, now. My interest began to sharpen in the area of brain development and the protracted nature of brain development, in part because the imaging technologies began to mature in a way that made many of the most interesting questions about brain development tractable for the first time. In some early work that we did quite a long time ago, over 20 years ago now, we were among the first to observe that there were brain morphological changes that you could mm-hmm. see with anatomical imaging techniques in typically developing children that went on for much longer than we really expected to see morphological changes in the brain. And for example, we noticed that when we tried to measure the cortical thickness of the human cerebral cortex, that children appeared to have a much thicker cortex than young adults did. And so we followed that up by looking at the time course of it, and we could see that there was something going on in the development of the biological development of the brain, and particularly in the cortex, that went on for a long time in development, even into young adulthood. And even at the time, we knew that probably those changes that we could see were very complex changes. They had to do with microstructural changes in the brain, probably related to ongoing changes in the connectivity in the brain and the maturation in the brain fiber tracts, because that's one thing we knew from basic research before that, from pathology studies, that for example, the myelination of the brain's fiber tracts is a much more protracted process.
Right.
And so we thought that's probably, it was at least part of what was going on, but the methods were not really, they didn't really allow us to examine those hypotheses in any detail.
You think they've matured to that point? I mean, there's been a criticism lately of, you know, I've seen papers about people believe stuff just because there's an fMRI image in there.
Right, right.
There was a critique of voodoo science.
Absolutely.
And Medvol and
yeah.
so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
so let me first of all distinguish.
Are you comfortable with
oh, well, first of all, let me say that most of the work that I've done and the work that I just described
yeah.
is not with functional MRI, it's with structural MRI.
Okay.
Not to say that there aren't challenges to the interpretation of structural MRI, because there certainly are. And some of them are similar to the challenges that have been described with fMRI. But I think what we observed, and the point that I'm trying to make, is that what we observed with structural imaging in children of different ages was that there were clearly biological changes in the brain that were that showed a very protracted developmental time course. The challenge is understanding what are the neural events that underlie those changes, and what relationship do they have to the developing behavior of
yeah.
a child, right? So that, it's true that the meaning of those changes that we could very clearly and very reliably measure in children, in the morphology of their brains, and in the biological signals that we're able to get from MRI, from structural MRI. No question that those changes were going on. The question of what they were, how we should interpret them, how we should label them, has been a constant challenge. Yeah. So in that sense, yes, there still are challenges, and people sometimes perhaps too glibly assign these changes to a particular neural phenomenon that we don't really, that we can't really link them to directly yet.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, there's a little bit of voodoo going on sometimes. People just kind of make a sort of speculation about what the neural explanation is that isn't there yet. But even so, it's important to understand how they relate to behavior.
So two questions. I mean, first of all, just gloss for me a little bit more, if you would, these changes in thickness and cortex.
Right.
And then go on to what you think the correlation to behavior is, causation correlation.
Right. Well, the changes that we measure in developing children in the cortex is just about any way you try to measure the thickness of the cortex. You see that overall, there are fairly dramatic reductions in the apparent thickness of the cortex. Now, there are some early increases in the thickness of the cortex that you can measure, particularly in certain parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not everywhere the same. But overall, in the childhood, the school age years and the adolescent years, there's what appears to be cortical thinning. The question is it true thinning of the cortex as we know it? Or to what extent is it changes in the biology of the cortex?
Yeah.
And particularly in, for example, the myelination of the fibers that run just inside of the cortex, sort of the white matter that runs inside the cortical ribbon, could myelination there or even within the cortex change the apparent thickness of the cortex? So it's maybe not even really the cortex changing so much as the fiber tracts that are still maturing.
Right.
These are some of the questions. We do have evidence from other sources that there are changes in synaptic density and dendritic density and connectivity within the cortex, and people have sometimes tried to link these two things and said, this cortical thinning, it must be this change in synaptic density. And that's not an unreasonable question to ask, but it isn't yet established.
But I'm saying to you, if you're at a cocktail party talking to a parent and you were telling them that their children's cortex was actually getting thinner, in other words, they would think their brain was going away.
Right.
I mean,
right?
How do you context that?
And what I try to tell people when they ask me those kinds of questions is that it would be more accurate for us to say that there are ongoing dynamic biological changes in the brain that show a long developmental time course.
Right.
We don't yet understand exactly what neural events underlie those dynamic changes, but we do know that they're associated with with a tremendous improvement in the specificity and expertise in the processing that's going on in those neural systems. So clearly, they are not, the result of degenerative effects. They are the result of a continuing tuning of the nervous system
and
an improvement in the specificity and the fluency of many mental processes.
Yeah.
So they're not a negative thing. They're clearly a part of they reflect the processes that are ongoing that give rise to mature adult highly specific behaviors.
Let's go back to the question I asked you about the temporal dynamics of learning center. Which is what we're associated with here, which is one of the co-sponsors of MBES.
Right.
As I look through your papers, I see that one of the most recent ones was effects of methamphetamine dependence and HIV infectiveness on cerebral morphology. I mean, that...
Yes. Seems far away
yes.
from the PDLC. Well, it's interesting. I mean, this work comes out of a program that I've been involved in for many years.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting program. I've learned a tremendous amount about the brain from it. And I think that one of the things that I've learned from that program that I think is most important in the work that I'm doing now in the TDLC is this idea that the brain, even at a structural level, is an extraordinarily dynamic place.
Yeah.
You know, I think we used to have this old-fashioned view we had was that the sort of anatomy gets set up very early in life.
Yeah.
It's kind of the cabling in the brain, the sort of the infrastructure of the brain. And then everything else that happens is purely at the functional level, and it's not, it's learning and loading up the software and so on. The hardware is kind of set early. And I think that's an inappropriate view of what it's like to be in the brain. The brain is like a busy metropolitan region.
Hmm.
There are lots of different kinds of players there. There are lots of different kinds of cells. It's not all about the neurons. Although the neurons obviously themselves are very dynamic. They interact with all the other cell populations.
Mm-hmm.
They're responding to all kinds of influences all the time. So they're responding to activity, and we think of this as neuroplasticity and learning, but they're also responding to disease, infection, toxicity associated with drugs. They're responding to lots of things all the time. And those responses are so vigorous that sometimes they show up even in structural imaging, which we think of as just showing us the basic anatomy of the brain. And so that's, it's sort of just seeing those kinds of things going on in the brains of people who are living with HIV and experiencing, you know, the ups and downs that go with living with HIV. I think it's been an important lesson to me about just the robustness and the dynamism that characterizes brain tissues. And so that has informed, I think, my interest, which is apart from that interest in HIV and methamphetamine, which is about the developing human brain.
Right.
How we conceptualize the developing human brain. And really my interest, my strongest interest in research right now is in the relationship between that and what I would call individuality, or what I think most people would call individuality. And I think that, interestingly enough, my experience in studying disease and toxicity and drugs and all those effects on the brain has helped me to understand more about how we might conceptualize this also highly dynamic place, which is the brain while it's developing in children,
right. And
the impact of different kinds of factors that together give rise to what we think of as individuality. And I think the individuality, understanding individuality, for lack of a better term, is critical to improving education. It's absolutely critical to improving education. Because I think in really understanding individuality better, it will entirely change our conception of the nature of human intelligence and creativity. And we need to do that. I think many of the problems we're having in education are because in the behavioral and cognitive sciences, we have kind of dumbed down, I think, our conception of human intelligence and creativity. I think that for some reason, although the research in human cognitive neuroscience has been exploding, and we've learned so many interesting and unusual things about the brain, things that we were not expecting about the brain, and sort of how we perform so many different kinds of cognitive things, but we tend to still come back to a rather oversimple view of the structure of human intelligence and the nature of differences in human intellectual and creative abilities and potential. And so I think that we need to understand individuality because we need to expand our conceptualization of human intelligence and creativity.
I co-authored a book some years ago called The Origin of Minds with Peggy Lacerra, and we in fact talked about the development of adaptive representational networks, which were very acutely attuned to individuals. And one has always thought about a science of individuality, but it's kind of a strange idea, that, isn't it? Because science requires large populations.
Right.
The notion of individual difference is almost inimical to that.
Yeah, the paradigms that we tend to use as behavioral scientists treat individual difference variability as noise much of the time.
Noise, right.
And I think, I wouldn't say that, you know, kind of scientists are not aware of the importance of individual differences. I think they are. But it's true that we have become, we so habitually apply this group paradigm to our attempts to find effects.
Yeah.
That I think we have really lost a lot of information
in
structuring our science in that way.
The story is often in the noise, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, that's really the sort of my most intense interest in research these days, and the work that I'm doing in the Center for Human Development and with the TDLC.
Right.
Is to try to really better understand the development of individuality. And if I could talk for a minute about what I mean by individuality, you know, and this kind of, I think, is relevant to the concept of the temporal dynamics. You know, we have this sort of common sense notion of individuality that's about the fact that different people will behave differently in the same circumstances, right? And we sort of all know that this is partly about things we think of as being kind of like traits, different personalities or different abilities or something like that. And some of it is about different states, like a person's feeling good or feeling bad or feeling sad or something at that time, not necessarily about how they are over the long haul, but simply about how they are right now. So we all know that behavioral differences are a combination of those things.
Right.
And I think more and more we understand behavioral dynamics and the neural dynamics that go with them as all being constantly adaptive, as being under dynamic change all the time.
Yeah.
So I think we realize now that there probably is no such thing as a fixed trait behaviorally. But there are differences if you in terms of this complex dynamic that gives rise to a person's particular behavioral response in a particular situation. There are some parameters that guide those dynamics that change only very slowly and others that change much more rapidly.
Hmm.
And so there is this continuum in human behavior between parameters that are relatively more slowly changing, and we think of those as being more trait-like, that a person will pretty consistently behave in a certain way, and other things that are which are much more fast-changing and which are more state-like. And I'm interested in the things on the trait side of the dimension and how they relate to individuality at the neural architectural level.
Right. But have you practiced as a psychiatrist?
I'm a clinical psychologist. But my practice as a clinical psychologist was as a neuropsychologist.
So where I was going to go with that is to say that if you have this perspective of people changing over time, you know that even revisiting a memory will change it. Because the circuitry will change.
Absolutely.
Isn't there this enormous paradox of how you counsel somebody about what they should do with their life if you're, on the one hand, saying that they have these traits, and on the other hand, you're saying, but these traits change. It's paradoxical.
I don't think so. I think, in fact, that it's very empowering for a person to realize that who you are is is a combination of things that it's because they probably in part because they have taken a long time to emerge, probably are going to take a long time to change significantly.
Yeah.
And things that are more amenable to quicker change.
Right. Right.
And that when if there's a problem in your life that you would like to address by changing something about your behavior, if you can begin to think of it as having these different components, you can make better sense of your own struggles, I think. And I think, you know, the idea that there are things that are not malleable, that you'll never be able to change, is really an impediment to people understanding that some things are harder to change. They just take more time because they developed more gradually, and there's a lot more of the system that is linked to those parameters, and so it's going to take longer for the adaptation to occur for that to change. So I think, you know, in a clinical situation, and by the way, I didn't do this kind of clinical work. I did the assessment of cognitive and intellectual functions in an assessments format. But I think that this is kind of an empowering idea for a person who's struggling to change something about his or her behavior to have.
All right, so Center for Human Development.
Right.
That's a large remit. I mean.
Yes.
What do you want to do?
Well, it's really not so much what I want to do as what any of the investigators at UCSD or even beyond want to do in the Center for Human Development. So in the Center for Human Development, we are trying to develop sort of an infrastructure which is supportive of investigators who are interested in human development at many different levels.
Yeah.
In the way the TDLC is trying to do something similar, we're trying to provide the means for people to bring their ideas into the center and perform the research in such a way that it makes maximum contact with other people's research and other people's ideas. And sometimes that means trying to study the same children.
Yeah.
If you're interested in development in a certain age range,
right.
Studying the same children as some of your colleagues are studying just so that you can begin to put what you're learning about them together with what your colleague is learning about them. That can be as simple as that. or to develop centralized and shareable databases, so that when you're interested in pursuing an idea, you can go to this shareable database and interrogate that database and sort of explore the sort of plausibility of some idea you have about how things develop or something like that. So these are some of the infrastructure elements that we're trying to put in place to help investigators increase the scientific yield of their individual investigator-driven research programs.
Right.
And so that's kind of what the Center for Human Development is about.
So when there was a little Terry Jernigan, I mean,
so long ago.
What got you onto this path? Was there a teacher, a book? Were your parents involved in science?
No. My parents were not involved in science. I think I was interested in behavior and human behavior and psychology from a very early age.
Really?
Very early age. I can remember that I actually told someone when I was 12 years old that I was going to be a psychologist.
Oh my gosh.
Now, I didn't know what a psychologist was, so I'm not sure how meaningful that statement was, but I actually said that. So I have had a long-term interest in human behavior. But as a graduate student, I became impatient with what I saw as sort of the, you know, I was a little impatient with how difficult it was to really understand in some explanatory way how human behavior works and why, what drives human behavior. So I became much more interested in the neural side of things.
And as an undergraduate, you'd done psychology?
Yeah. Yes. Well, actually, I my degree is from social sciences at UCI, yes, behavioral sciences, basically.
Yeah.
And so I did, and at that time, there were a lot of really interesting things happening in, behavioral neurology and and the Boston group, people were making these very interesting observations about, mostly about brain damage patients and really unusual phenomena that occurred in that context. So I became interested in neuropsychology, which was really in its very beginning at that time.
Right.
And so I got interested in getting some training in neuropsychology and started pursuing venues, trying to find venues where I could get training in neuropsychology. And I ended up in Palo Alto doing some clinical training as part of my clinical degree.
Yeah.
And I found out from one of my colleagues that there was a machine that was being built in the basement of this hospital. And it was, astonishingly enough, a machine that would allow you to look at the structure of the human brain inside the skull in 3D in living people. And I was just astonished by this. Thought this was the most wonderful thing I'd ever heard of. And long story short, I got myself situated as a volunteer working on this machine
with
in
whom?
The evening.
Who was that?
Well, there was a group there who were beginning to want, were trying to use this machine to study aphasia patients.
Right.
And so Marnie Naser was there at the time. She's a neurolinguist. She's been in Boston for a long time, but she was in Palo Alto at the time. And there was a neuroradiologist, Les Zatz, who was running the radiology service there. And he was, of course, in charge of this machine. It was a prototype CT scanner. So I was a computer programmer, fortunately. I'd done that to try to support myself as an undergraduate. And so I was able to go after the hour, after hours, when they were running these early clinical CT scans, and program this computer and try to get the numbers out and try to figure out how you use this information to find the damage in the brain and quantify it. And that, and in the process of doing that, I created these pictures, which were very crude pictures by today's standards, made on a teletype machine by using different symbols like asterisks and dashes and dots to make a picture of the brain. And I was simply hypnotized by these pictures, because I could make pictures that were sort of pictures that summed information over different people in a way.
Yeah.
That I felt were the first time anyone had ever seen that picture. And that was very, that was sort of addictive for
transforming.
Me. To be able to see, visualize things with this technique that had, as far as I could tell, never been seen by anybody before.
Yeah.
And that has pretty much sustained me through my career. I've never gotten over that thrill of seeing some phenomenon of interest visualized in the human brain for the first time, if you will. So I think that that's why my work has always involved imaging. And that's how it happened. I just happened to be in the right place.
And then you've gone this interesting trajectory. I mean, there's a little book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. As you think back, I mean, what do you tell new scientists under your tutelage? I mean, what are the key things that people need to do?
To me, I know this is almost trite, but you have to pay a lot of attention to your emotional response. Mm. I think this is the most really critical thing, is if you have to pay attention not just to the political, I mean, it's easy to figure out what's the zeitgeist,
mm-hmm.
but if something really excites you, if an idea excites you, if a process, a scientific process excites you, if there's something about it, the challenge is very engaging to you, you should pay attention to that. And because to me, the best work in science is almost always driven in that way, that they're, for reasons that are often very difficult to explain at an individual level. There's just something very engaging and seductive about an area of research for a particular person, and that becomes a passion for them.
Yeah.
And I think that the level of expertise and specialization that you have to acquire to be competitive in science today is hard to achieve if you don't have an enormous appetite for the process of gaining that expertise. So I don't mean to say that I think all the best scientists are very extremely specialized in their expertise. I think that can be broadly defined. It can be a whole area of research that fascinates you, and you want to learn as many different aspects of it as possible. That can be similarly empowering as a scientist. But there has to be that fascination or the sport has to engage you.
Yeah, a passion to know. But don't you also find a slight contradiction there in the sense that the amount of specialization that's required at these points often blinkers people to the wide field of what's available?
Sure. I mean, I think that's always a risk. And I think that the best defense against that, certainly for me, has been to find brilliant collaborators and work with them on teams who have expertise which is very different from mine, but equally relevant to the problems I'm so interested in. So that has been, because if you find people to be on your team whose intellect you really respect and whose expertise you really respect, they're not going to let you get away with narrowing too much.
Yeah.
And so that's my anecdote. I mean, that's my antidote to that specialization.
In terms of the place of science in society, this is a question I ask everybody. When he started the administration, President Obama said that it would restore science to its rightful place. What do you think the rightful place of science is in society?
Well, that's a big question.
That's a big question.
Well, I mean, I think science is an indispensable part of a civilized society. And I think that I think science has to constantly make contact with the rest of what's going on in society. I really do believe that we suffer tremendously as scientists when we're too siloed. And particularly in our field, you know, how can you think that you have a broad and powerfully explanatory understanding of the nature of human behavior if you live in a silo where there clearly is only there is a restricted range of human behavior? And in fact, I think a lot of the errors in cognitive science, and we heard Helen talk about this a little bit yesterday.
Helen Neville.
Some of the errors, the most significant errors that we've made as behavioral scientists stem either directly or indirectly from this relative isolation that we have in the academy from the rest of society. It's really damaging to us.
Yeah.
Because the stuff we're trying to study exists all over the society, not just in our little subculture. So I think that's, you know, in our science in particular, we absolutely must always be making as much contact with the wider society as we possibly can, and interacting with people, gauging their reactions to the findings that we have, And trying to gain a better understanding of how they interpret it. What do they hear? When we say things in our scientifically, sometimes kind of arcane way, what do they hear? What is the interpretation? I think some problems that we've had in advancing the most important goals of science have faltered because we've not been paying attention to what people in the wider society hear when we talk. And I think that that's another reason that, you know, if we want to, even if we want to protect the narrow interests of science, we have to pay more attention to what people hear us saying, what they think the meaning of that is.
Yeah.
And we have to be constantly critical about whether, you know, because sometimes I think we as scientists, because we are a narrow range of phenotypes, don't have a very broad understanding of our own findings. We can become, we can understand them in a kind of encapsulated way.
Yeah.
That that you know, actually distorts their meaning, their real meaning. So I think that another important part of having a much more active dialogue between the scientific community and communities that are not, don't think of themselves as being scientific or scientists, another important thing is simply to reality check for our own ideas about what our findings mean.
Yeah. One of the things that I find when I talk to students, graduate students, and so on, is that they, although they're interested in this, they have very little context in the history of science. So they have no clue that Vannevar Bush wrote a proposal in 1945 and gave it to, originally commissioned by FDR, gave it to Truman, it became the National Science Foundation. He also was at MIT, wrote this thing about this thing called Memex, which is really the World Wide Web and Google and so on. They have no sense of context. So one question I ask people so that I can pass this on is, if I gave you a time travel token and said to you, you can bring anybody from history or wherever to your dinner table and ask him questions, who really intrigues you at this point? Who would you like to talk to?
Oh, God. That's, you have a lot of hard questions. That's really hard. At the moment, I think I would say Richard Feynman.
Feynman?
Yes. I think so.
Why?
If I could have just a conversation. Well, he famously said, and I can't remember exactly the quote, but it's something like, a scientist, when trying to solve a non-scientific problem, is as dumb as the next guy.
Yeah.
And I would love to know more about what he meant by that. And I think, you know, it seems like just a funny thing to say, but I think it's something profound about that. And I think that he was an interesting scientist, not only, of course, because he was a brilliant physicist, but because he did think a little bit more broadly about things, about mm-hmm. society and the culture and people, how they differ from each other.
Yeah.
And so I would like the kind, I'll bet that I would be able to get insights from him about even the sort of physics knowledge and how different people understand physics. And I think that would be, you know, from people who actually arguably understand a body of knowledge as well as anybody
yeah.
who was living at the time.
Yeah.
This kind of insight about different ways of understanding something as important as physics, I think would be very helpful to me at this point in my research.
Where do you think, so where is your research going at this point?
So, as I say, what I'm interested in is this relationship between neural architectural variability
Yeah.
And behavioral phenotypic variability. Okay. So, but the conceptualization that I have of it is that it can only be understood from a developmental perspective. So I believe that some aspects of who we end up being as we're developing, our mental characteristics and qualities, our personalities, our knowledge, what knowledge we gain, what expertise we develop, all those things that end up differentiating us from other people, that those things develop in part because of differences that are present very early.
Right.
We think of those things as constitutional or genetic or whatever you want to call them, but there are differences that are present very early, and they influence this process, this developmental process. And that obviously then our experiences tremendously influence that process. What kinds of knowledge we encounter, what opportunities we have to practice skills and mental tasks and so on. So our experience is very important. But to me, the critical thing to understand is the way these early differences that I think of as more constitutional interact with the particular experiences that we have. And from an so what I'm really talking about is the nature of the most important interactions between culture and within that education.
Yeah.
And differences that exist very early in our sort of constitutional factors. So I believe that you can explain a lot of the variability in, say, in educational outcomes, not on the basis of differences in our neural genotypes or our neural architectural phenotypes, though those things influence it, but in the match between what we have developed as our educational approach and those attributes.
Right.
So it's not that the outcome is a direct result of differences in the neural genotype or the neural phenotype, however you want to think of it. But there are critical interactions that occur that give rise to outcomes in education that are an important part of the outcome in education. So the important thing about understanding in that way, in my opinion, is that it means that the outcome could be very different with a different culture, a different educational approach, right? So if it's the interaction between those things, or the match between those things that matters, then the goal is to make sure that the culture, which is highly malleable, changes to be adaptive to the range of variability in the neural genotype.
So you're actually trying to give more depth to the usual gloss about, well, it's both genes and development and da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Which is
right.
A kind of a cop-out.
Right.
I mean, it's true, but it's kind of boring.
Right. Yeah.
We need to get a better in-depth analysis of what that statement really means.
Yeah. So I think of it in terms of salience.
Right.
That's the concept that I use to think of it. That part of it is mediated by the fact that different kinds of information have different salience to different people.
Right.
And I use that term because it's a little bit vague with respect to, there are a lot of different things that can make something more or less salient to you.
Yeah.
And but I think that that differences in salience can emerge because of your experiences with a particular situation, but they can also emerge because you make sense of the world in a somewhat different way than other people do.
Right.
And so I think if we focus on, if we find a way to more accurately assess the salience of the information that we're presenting to a learner, we'll understand a lot better the outcome of that learning experience and the differences among people. And I think one interesting question is, does this critical concept of salience that I think mediates the sort of the learning that goes on in a certain situation, is it primarily, should we think of it primarily as a cognitive phenomenon? Or should we at least consider the possibility that it is, you know, salience has to do with reward. So I don't think you can ever understand salience without entirely as a cognitive phenomenon. You have to think of it as a phenomenon which is situated within the reward dynamics of the individual, right? And so I think that is, in the same way that I would advise a young scientist to pursue the salient, the thing that is emotionally and intellectually salient to him or her. I think that the difference between people who really get on the academic bandwagon and succeed and develop strong academic and intellectual skills and the people who don't is situated very much at this salience point. So to me, a thoroughgoing scientific approach to understanding the dynamics of salience in the learning context. What are the circumstances that give rise to it? How is it defined differently from one individual to the next? Could be very productive. Because if you can, if first of all, I think everything I know from human cognitive neuroscientists in this general area of individuality, what we know about individuality, implies very strongly that education of the future has to be adaptive. It has to be much more adaptive. Because there is not going to be an optimal educational approach. The only optimal educational approach is going to be highly adaptive to the individual, both in terms of where the individual is and his or her mastery of the to-be-learned material, but also in terms of who the individual is. And so we just need to get on with that. But we don't have the empirical science that informs what you should be, what are the actual critical things you should be adapting to. How should you be adapting? I mean, we have some ideas. We sort of understand that there's a sort of hierarchy in your mastery of certain kinds of material, and that if you give people things that are too far above where they are now, that's not helpful, or if it's too far below where they are now. We know that, that we need to adapt to that level of mastery. But I think there are many other important ways that we need to learn how to adapt educational techniques to the individual. And I think technology will enable this if we're, you know, if we use all the computational resources that we have in the TDLC, for example, and all the expertise that we have, we can do this. But we need to understand at a more basic level what is the what are the critical dynamics that we need to produce for the individual to make to increase as far as possible the probability that that appetitive dynamic develops in that individual.
But you're talking there about the neural correlate, as Dan Hege would put it, neural correlates of engagement. You're talking about dopamine, you're talking about early life oxytocin stuff. I mean, it's a very complicated system.
Well, it's a complicated system, but that doesn't mean that there are no ways to try to improve our ability to recognize engagement. I mean, I think that's a good example. Engagement is a construct we all understand, but we don't actually have very powerful tools for identifying it in a student or a learner? We don't.
Yeah.
So if we think it's very important, and I happen to think it's very important, it has to do with this idea of salience, right?
Right.
Then we ought to be able, we ought to be trying to figure out how to identify it.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll understand everything about the neural dynamics of it. If we can just identify it, that's an important first step.
So I mean, to go back to Feynman, he said after the Challenger mission, after the explosion, he said for a successful technology, reality must be engaged because nature cannot be fooled, something roughly like that.
Yeah.
So you're basically saying we have to understand this at a very basic level.
Yes.
And
yes, we have to understand.
And education can't move forward without some basic understanding of these kind of drives.
Education can move forward on many fronts. I mean, a respected colleague, Adele Diamond, once said in a conference, I think you were there too, that all answers in education are partial answers.
Yeah.
So there are many ways to move forward in education, and I would be the last person to say that the problems that I have identified that I think are very important are the only problems that need to be solved in education.
Right.
But I do believe that there's a barrier beyond which we cannot move if we don't address this issue of the critical, sometimes positive, often negative interaction between education as we have conceptualized it and the variability that exists in our society, in our species, and in the sort of neural phenotype.
Within individuals.
And so I think, honestly, that it is a kind of geocentric model that we have of human intelligence, in the sense that we have, as behavioral scientists and as academics, kind of anointed a certain narrow range of phenotypes as being the elite ones. And these phenotypes are suspiciously like ours. So I think we do need to have a more empirical, more data-driven science that puts together the variability that we actually observe in people with their responses to different behavioral contexts.
Right. So must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled.
Yes.
To finish the Feynman quote. Final question. What are you optimistic about?
Oh, what am I optimistic about?
Yeah.
I think, with respect to these questions that we're talking about now, I think the next decade is going to be completely transformative. Completely transformative. I don't think the classroom is going to look anything like it looks today in 10 years. And I think it's going to be much, much more powerful and more a happier place to be for many kids. And I think, because I really see these ideas as bubbling up in many different places.
Yeah.
It's been a golden age of neuroscience for some time. I've been fortunate enough to live through much of that. And I think, so a lot of really limiting misconceptions about the brain and have been, you know, kind of cleared out. So we have a much more, a better understanding of the potential and the dynamics of, you know, neuroplasticity, for example. So I think that's a good thing, and that helps. But I think now you see people, you know, the impact in cognitive sciences and behavioral sciences is really beginning to be felt and more real. You know, people are beginning to make better contact. Now, that not to say we don't have some problems that we still need to work on and clearly this is this area in education and neuroscience and behavioral science and putting them together. There are some real challenges here because, you know, there's some mistakes have been made, as they say. And sometimes I think the partnership is not is, you know, it is, people are not quite to the point that they really have the level of respect that they need to have for each other in, from these different disciplines and different perspectives.
Yeah.
But I think it's getting there. I think there's a lot of, we've gotten over the initial squabbles and it's settled into a more workable relationship. That's my view.
Okay. I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay.
Terry Jernigan, thanks very much.
Thank you.